Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Religious freedom, the ability to live and act according to one's faith, is one of our most fundamental human rights. But as Western society has secularized, the importance of religious freedom seems to have been eclipsed by other concerns. Indeed, freedom of religion is too often devalued in the public square, and in some places in the world, is under direct and even violent assault. No one has put more thought into this urgent concern and what to do about it than Sam Brownback, returning for his fifth interview on Humanize. Brownback was the ambassador at large for international religious freedom in the first Trump administration from February 2018 to January 2021. Before that, he served his state of Kansas as governor, U.S. senator, a member of the House of Representatives, and Secretary of Agriculture. While a member of the Senate, he worked actively on the issue of religious freedom in multiple countries and was a key sponsor of the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. Ambassador Brownback currently serves as co-chair of the International Religious Freedom Summit and is a senior fellow at Global Christian Relief. He is also chairman of the National Committee for Religious Freedom, which he founded in 2021. Sam, welcome back to Humanize.
Hey, Wesley, thank you so much. What an honor to be back with you. I love your work. I love what you're doing. Keep it up. I get your post from time to time looking at it going, man, there's Wesley out there punching it again. That's great. Glad you're doing it.
Well, it takes one to know one, Sam. You've been in the nonprofit sector now for more than 4 years. What do you enjoy about that work? And what, if anything, do you find difficult or frustrating?
The second part's easier than the first, probably, but keeping money coming in, raising the funds for it. I was in Congress and governorship, had all these nonprofits coming in and everything, and I go, yeah, okay. And I never realized how difficult it was just keeping the lights on in places and what effort people have to go through to get enough funds just to keep it going. I mean, everybody, you know, they love what you're doing, but it's like, well, let somebody else pay for it. So just that piece of it's been the one that's really kind of been the striking. But you depend on the Lord and he comes on through. I do love the ability to just really hone in and focus on an area. You don't get that in public life. Public life, you got to do everything, and everything that comes in, you got to address it. But in the nonprofit, I get, I'm focused in religious freedom, what are the issues, and you can really swing hard at a key topic and hopefully make a difference.
It's the difference between being a generalist and a specialist.
Yeah, it is. Honestly, I mean, in law, they say the specific controls over the general. You know, if you can really hit that specific topic with clarity and specificity and truth and passion, you can move the ball on it. And certainly that's what I've felt like we desperately have needed to do on religious freedom, both around the world and in the United States.
I know the answer to this, but some of our listeners might not. Why did you found the National Committee on Religious Freedom?
I'd worked so much on international religious freedom issues, going around the globe, trying to get people out of jail, keep them from being killed, all the persecution. And I come back working on things here at home and see how much we have declined on religious freedom and the persecution that was happening here, particularly during the prior Biden administration. And I'm just going, you know, this is, it's horrible for the United States. It is double horrible for the rest of the world, because any ground you lose on religious freedom here is magnified around the world. But then the authoritarians would say, well, the United States doesn't allow this, and we're the standard bearer for this. It declines for everybody. So you got to protect the mothership, or as we would say in farm country, the mother cow. You got to take care of her, or you're not going to have anything. That's we've got to do better. And I am, praise be to God for Donald Trump and him standing up and fighting for religious freedom and seeing the need both here at home and internationally to stand up for this central human right of the soul.
Let's talk about what that is actually. Freedom of religion is more than freedom of worship, isn't it?
Absolutely. And too many on the left want to define it just as freedom of worship. You've got a place you can go into, you can sing your hymns, you can talk there, but when you come out, you don't have freedom of religion. You've got freedom of worship. Well, that's not what the founders gave us. They gave us freedom of religion. You can bring your religion into the public square. You can't kill people. You got to be respectful of other people, but you can bring your values and your entitlement. And indeed, the founders saw this as a great need for a country as robustly freedom-oriented as this one. You had to have this self-governance mechanism, and they saw self-governance as generally coming from religion.
That's the free exercise of religion clause in the Constitution, meaning that you have a right, and it's been determined, and I believe the Supreme Court as well, to live according to your faith. Again, of course, no right is absolute. You can't engage in child sacrifice and things like that. But you have a right to live according to your faith. And the point of the free exercise clause is that government should not constrain you from that. Am I getting that correct?
You're completely spot on. And the founders, I really believe this was divinely inspired, because it was just brilliant. They put in that First Amendment, there will not be a national church. We will not establish a church of America, because they come from Europe where everybody, there was a national church, and the national church exists, but generally persecuted everybody else. We're not going to have that. But you also will be completely free, and we will guarantee your right to practice your faith, whatever that faith might be. And they put those two together in the same 16 words that just flow together. And you're going, this is absolutely brilliant. Kept us from having a national faith that would probably persecute other faiths. And you are free to practice your faith. Indeed, we want to encourage you to practice your faith, because the rest of a very robust, liberty-oriented country can't work unless you have, again, that self-governing mechanism within you that pushes you away from evil and towards good.
Some people have claimed that those who stand for religious freedom are trying to create a theocracy. Now, freedom of religion also means you cannot be coerced to practice religion, right?
That's absolutely true. No, you cannot. You cannot compulse somebody else to do something else, because particularly if you use the power of government to do this, that is the Establishment Clause. That's that first piece, that there will be not be a national church. What you've seen, though, Wesley, over time has taken place is for the last 50 years prior to this current Supreme Court, was everything was kind of defined as Establishment Clause. You can't pray in school because that violates Establishment Clause. You can't pray at a football game because that violates Establishment Clause. And what you've seen is this Supreme Court has swung back and say, no, you have the free exercise to be able to practice your faith in public or in private. So you can do those things. And even President Trump today is issuing an executive order, or directing Department of Education that protect prayer in schools, which I might remind you, we've had in the public schools in the United States for the first 200 years of our existence. And only in the last 50 have we decided, that must be establishment. You're not establishing a religion. This isn't the Methodist book of prayer that you're requiring to be done in the public school. This is a prayer unto God in this nation that strongly has this faith orientation and connection, and whose motto is, "In God we trust."
when you're talking about freedom of religion, you're not just talking about freedom for Christians, right?
No, this is everybody. And it has to be everybody, Wesley. You know, some people, and I'm a strong follower of Jesus. I believe Jesus, and he's my Lord and Savior. But this protects Hindus, this protects Jews, Muslims, it protects atheists as well, because there's a point of view that some would deem a religious point of view there. It protects everybody, and it has to protect everybody, or it doesn't work. If it doesn't protect everybody, if it just protects me and my faith, then it's not a universal right. And this is a universal right for everybody in this country
and around the world. And the idea is, in a sense, akin to a freedom of conscience based on one's faith or based on one's beliefs, so that power cannot force you, as in the old Roman days, when the Roman emperors wanted everyone to give tribute to Caesar as a god, and Christians didn't want to do that, and sometimes were killed because they refused to do that because of their conscience. It really protects all of us, including, as you mentioned, atheists or agnostics, from the power of the state to coerce someone to engage in something in which they do not believe.
Absolutely. And man, we would not want it any other way than that. You've just got to protect that conscience, right? That's why I call freedom of religion the human right of the soul. This is the deepest center part of your being, of who you are. And you're protecting the right of that, of your soul, to follow whatever route it chooses and believes it should. And this is your God-given right. This is why God gave us freedom in the first place, to choose. And no government should coerce that. No public sector should coerce that. You should be completely free to be able to follow the dictates of your conscience, of your heart.
This brings up something that Senator Tim Kaine said the other day as we're recording this. He said that rights come from government and law, and he equated the idea that rights come from God to the Iranian theocracy. What did you make of that statement by Senator Tim Kaine?
I found it very troubling, particularly from somebody in the U.S. Senate to make that, which to me was such a clear error of what the founding of this nation and the basis of this nation is all about. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their government. No, well, wait a minute. Endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And I mean, when he is particularly a senator from Virginia, home of Thomas Jefferson, of religious freedom, of the writer of the Declaration of Independence, you're going, this hope, it doesn't reflect a movement on the part of the Democrat Party that says, no, your rights come from government, because that is horrifically dangerous for us to internalize as a society, because they just don't.
Which government gives, government can take away.
And does in way too many places around the world. Too many places around.
This is the concept, I believe, of natural rights, which is certainly what the founders of our country believed in, which has to do with belief in a God, and that we are endowed, as Jefferson said, by our Creator, with inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty includes religious freedom. In fact, John Adams was involved with that issue. George Washington strongly believed in religion and religious freedom, regardless of his own personal faith pursuits. And if our rights come from government, there's no such thing as natural rights. There's whatever rights that those in power decide to allow us to have.
And think how dangerous that is. And you don't even have to think about it. Look how dangerous that is. For instance, the Chinese Communist Party that's run that nation for 75 years, they believe you have human rights, but they're communal rights. So it goes with what the community's best interest is. Okay, well, who defines that? Well, we do. Well, okay, then you can't follow Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or Falun Gong. You can't follow any of those things because we deem that bad for the community. It just goes down a very bad path of persecution and people being killed for their faith, which happens just so much around the world anymore.
And in China, you certainly can see that vividly because you've got Falun Gong, who are practitioners kind of a Tai Chi, kind of a Buddhist mysticism approach, actually being rounded up and organ harvested for the organ black market. You've got the Uyghur Muslims in Western China literally suffering genocide. You've got churches now being blown up in China. You've got the social credit system in China, where if you are seen going to church or attending a religious event, it becomes a demerit. And if you get enough demerits in the social credit system, you can't get a job, can't engage in public transportation or ride public transportation. Your children may be suffered, your friends may be. It's kind of an excommunication. And because of the tech issues in China, the power of things like AI and facial recognition, they are actually, in my view, establishing the most powerful tyranny in the history of the planet, the most potent tyranny, and it is focused on denying religious freedom. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
I don't think it is either. I'm writing a book on it coming out this next year. I think the most single greatest enemy of religion and people of faith around the world today is the Chinese Communist Party. And it's because of the things that you just identified and this thing that everybody that's listening to this knows. It's my cell phone, and everybody has one of these. This is a tracking device in China. And they are establishing the most draconian, vast network of abilities to control people anywhere in the world. They're deploying them in their nation, and they're now in 80 different countries with this technology, helping dictators be better dictators.
You know, somebody should tell Senator Kaine that, since he thinks that rights come from government. And if rights come from government, then the extent of rights also are determined by government. And in China, unless you go along with the program, you have no rights.
No. I mean, if you want to be a practicing Christian, you can go to the state-run church. Now, their sermons are going to be approved by the state, or they will not be a church anymore. And you're going to have the church of Xi Jinping. You're not having the church of whatever affiliation that you may have. You're going to have one that's subservient to the government. And that's not a church, that's a subsidiary of the government. No, you don't. The problem with this is, it's not just China. Now, I mean, they're spreading this network around the world. I am really concerned about what's happening here. And the target is initially religion, because religious people are the ones that would actually stand up to a government. And so they're the first ones to get targeted and the last ones left standing, because they won't leave from their faith, and they will believe in, okay, if I'm persecuted, I'm persecuted. I'm not giving up on it. But they are honestly one of our, if not our greatest ally in this fight for freedom as people of faith.
I think that's true. Unless, as people of faith, they want to squelch other people of faith, like you see in Iran.
Yeah. Well, and that's, again, your state-owned or state-run religion, which our founders keenly stayed away from, thankfully. But in Iran, okay, if you want to be a Shia Muslim in the sect and belief of what the Iranian leadership has, okay, you can practice your faith. Anybody else, you're in trouble. You're probably in jail or kicked out of the country or killed.
And that woman, if she takes off her hijab, her headscarf, she could be in prison.
In prison and killed.
Yeah.
For that simple of an act, that you look at, and we wouldn't honestly think about it twice in this country. If a woman has a scarf on, okay. If she doesn't, okay. I mean, but that's you. That's what you want to do. All right, that's fine. But in other places around the world, this can get you killed.
You can't have comity and mutual respect without religious freedom, because a lot of people put their faith into action, just as an example, as we're talking about, in the clothes they wear.
Yeah.
I mean, Jewish men wearing yarmulkes is another example, or wearing a cross around your neck.
Yeah. I grew up around a number of Amish in eastern Kansas. And I'm not Amish, but I have incredible respect for them and the sacrifices that they go through in this earthly existence for their view of what it will help them do in the next world, in the eternal. And I really admire them. a number of them around us don't drive motorized vehicles, or their kids don't go to school past the eighth grade. And you're kind of going, you know, that's not for me. I mean, I've got a law degree and I believe in education. And they do too, to a point. But then after that, they want people to, we want you really more working with your hands. And we think that's going to help you in the next life or this life to be more humble and move forward and into the next one. And I admire people willing to sacrifice like that for their.
You know, as I recall from law school, it's been a long time, but the eighth grade aspect of the Amish actually came out of a religious freedom controversy with the government. And the Amish did not want to send their kids to school, and the government tried to force it. And because we had the protection of religious freedom, this compromise was reached where they will send their kids to school until eighth grade. And that shows the comity that is potentially here in the United States because of religious freedom. That is, we protected kids' rights to have some education, but we also protected a community's rights and parents' rights to raise their children according to their religious faith.
Yeah, and it did come out of that, and that is absolutely correct. And it also reflects what we really need to do now, Wesley. I mean, we're such a diverse nation. This United States is a nation of nations. We've got people from everywhere in large numbers and of every religion. And we used to accommodate people. We used to say, okay, religion, this is a good thing, but we want to help. But, you know, we got certain standards that we want to have the food processed to this point for public safety when it's really a public safety issue. We've got to work this out, and we would accommodate. And that's the attitude we really need to get back to for people of faith, is just saying, okay, we respect your faith, we honor it. Now let's figure out how we can accommodate each other in this.
One of the criticisms of religious freedom comes from the LGBT community that claims that by allowing religious freedom, for example, people to say, I will not accommodate a same-sex marriage in my business, that you're actually not protecting freedom of religion, but you're allowing discrimination. How do you react to that criticism?
Yeah, I think it's a valid discussion. I think we need to have that discussion and about how do you accommodate in that circumstance. You know, we've had the cake baker cases that have been going back and forth up to the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, I think instead of it really being seen as, okay, how do we work this out? It's more of a, how do we fight about this for political gain or political purposes on both sides in some cases. I think what you need to do is to figure out what your accommodation is. We did this back when we were together on religious freedom as parties. Chuck Schumer and I worked together in the United States Senate to provide for religious accommodation for certain religious community that had to carry a ceremonial knife in their work. Well, someplace they went in, we don't want you here with the knife. Well, we said, well, wait a minute, it's a 6-inch total length, 6 inches knife, handle and everything. We can accommodate, we can figure out. And we required accommodation when it didn't put undue burdens on the group to accommodate. And I just think we've got to get back to that and have the discussion, but get back to really that sort of attitude and a respect and a reverence for religion.
And that's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a federal law that says if you infringe on somebody's free exercise of religion, then you must do so as a state in the least intrusive way possible, and you also have to show a compelling state interest. You were part of getting the RFRA through the Congress, weren't you?
No, that actually got through before I got there, but I helped get it in place as governor of Kansas. We did it in Kansas. This particular narrow piece was something specific later on that I dealt with, again, with Senator Schumer. But to me, the key piece of this here is this nation has had a long respect for religion. This is a very religious nation. As much as we've seen decline in people's affiliation with certain denominations, you still see this great spirituality in the United States. And actually a bottoming out and a starting to pick back up, it looks like, of people's affiliation with a religion. That's all been to our good as a nation. We need to have religious people. Donald Trump will talk about we need more religion in the United States. This country has been so blessed in so many ways, and we shouldn't walk away from the divine blessings that we have. We should figure out ways to really accommodate and to encourage the free exercise in this country of faith.
You know, the conflicts over free exercise versus, quote, discrimination, close quote, have mostly dealt with things like services such as baking specifically designed cakes or flower arrangements or photography. But there is an issue that I think is very serious in the same arena, which is medical conscience, where you now have many in bioethics and some in, actually, this is not a partisan show, but the Democrat Party, want to force, at least certain elements of it, want to force doctors, nurses, and others to participate in things such as abortion, which are morally contentious, such as assisted suicide, such as engaging in gender interventions, even for children, even though it might violate one's faith. And I've actually read articles in bioethics journals saying, well, if doctors and nurses aren't willing to do that, they should get out of medicine. Well, that's kind of a culling of medicine based on religious belief.
It is. I think clearly, look, we can work through these things and not require people to clearly violate their consciences. I mean, if I were a medical doctor and they told me I have to perform an abortion to work at this hospital, I'm out. I can't do this. I cannot. And I believe this is a child. I believe this is a human being. I believe the Ten Commandments that thou shalt not kill. I cannot and will not do this. And you shouldn't force me to do this either. I mean, that shouldn't be a requirement of going to work here, is that I violate a strongly held religious belief that's based in a religious view. But you're seeing too much of it. You know, particularly, Wesley, this last administration, the Biden administration, and I served with Joe Biden in the Senate. He wasn't this same way in the Senate that he was as president, but boy, did they misuse the power of government to try to force people to do things like this, or use the money that government puts, and government puts money in a lot of places, and a lot of it in healthcare. People see in a way, we can force people to have more abortion access by using this string on the federal government money or school lunch money or education money. And that's wrong. And we should push back on it in every instance. I'm glad to see President Trump pushing back on it, but we should never have started down that road. That's not the America that we've had for 250 years. And it's not the America that will carry us forward.
And you can see where that can lead. There are still laws in place protecting doctors from having to perform abortions in the country, although they're under assault. But in Canada, Ontario, the province of Ontario, when they legalized euthanasia, some Catholic doctors and other doctors brought a lawsuit. And they said, you cannot compel us to do that because the Canadian Charter, which is the equivalent of the American Constitution, explicitly protects freedom of conscience and religion. It's actually more explicit than the United States Constitution in the way it states it. Freedom of conscience and religion, that's the term. And the High Court in Ontario said, well, that's too bad because Canadians have a right to any legal medical procedure that the government pays for, and that counts more, even though that's not in the charter, that counts more than your freedom of religion and conscience, and said, if you don't like it, get out of medicine or go become some kind of a specialist that you won't have to face questions about killing a patient. Well, that's not freedom. That's not freedom at all. That's tyranny. If you can force somebody to kill someone or be complicit in that because the other option was what they called an effective referral, that is, you have to find a doctor, you have to procure the doctor to do the killing. When you can force someone to take an innocent human life, you're not in the military and this kind of thing, that's not freedom. And you see Canada, in my view, some of this is beyond the scope of this interview, for example, some of the freedom of speech issues, losing freedom. And I think it started with the loss of the belief in freedom of religion.
It's, to me, it's a cornerstone human right, Wesley. I mean, that if you can get this one right in a nation, you can build out your other rights. You can build out freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of press. You can really build, you get this one wrong, and those others start caving in as well. I really think this is a foundational cornerstone rite, and I've spoken about it that way. And it's also because it's generally the people that'll stand up and fight. Look at Martin Luther King Jr. in this country. Where did he organize his civil rights movements from?
Churches.
It's a black church, primarily. I've been to Selma in the church that they held their meeting before marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And it was a political rally, but they were singing hymns and praying that they wouldn't get killed doing this. They were organizing there. And you're going, that's what I mean about this is this key group of people, these religious people moved by their convictions to stand up to a tyrannical government or to a wrong in society, which is what religion should really move us towards, is to move to stand up against injustices. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere and will affect all of us. We really need to, whether you're a person of faith or not, look at this as just such a key one. And I think religious freedom should move from being a human right issue to a strategic national security issue. I think this is really, it is so foundational for freedoms, both in this country and around the world. We should see it really more as a national strategy and a security issue than even a human right.
How would that's interesting. I haven't heard that proposed before. How would that play out differently in terms of public policy and diplomacy?
Well, in diplomacy, it'd be the president standing up and saying, we believe human rights are critical, and the critical cornerstone of it is religious freedom, and we're going to stand and push and fight for this anywhere and everywhere in the world, and we're going to stand behind people that are persecuted for their faith anywhere and everywhere in the world, whether they're Vietnamese Catholics that are standing up to the government there because of some of the things they're doing to them, or Muslim Uyghurs that's what's taking place in China, or Falun Gong members. And we would back up, and to me, you'd take a different angle at the overall human rights project around the world. So instead of it being kind of something that comes and goes, one administration likes, another doesn't, we look at it as foundational to
But how is that national security?
If you don't do this, you grow in tyrannies around the world. More tyranny grows. The Chinese model gets stronger. I mean, we're in a global struggle with an evil empire that dwarfs what Ronald Reagan took on in the Soviet Union. The modern-day China with Russia and Iran as sidekicks, this, and the economic power and the technological capacity that they've developed, we are against a much stronger foe than the Soviet Union ever was.
And a smarter one, I think.
We need to make this a key part of our standing up to China.
So you're saying, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that it's a national security issue because when you promote religious freedom, that promotes freedom generally, and that holds back that horde, that Chinese attack on freedom that you were describing. So religious freedom supports the national security of the United States and the free world.
It does. And if China's already in 80 countries with their technological capacity to do surveillance on people, working with all these other dictators and moving on more, what did that do to us, leaders of the free world, but shrink the size of the world that we're operating in? This, to me, is a foundational national security issue in our confrontation with the evil empire that we're faced against today.
That's very interesting. I had not considered, I of course considered the human right aspect, but I had not considered the national security aspect. Thank you for that.
Well, why else do the Chinese go at religious people so hard? And why do they go at the Falun Gong with organ harvesting? I mean, that is really a diabolical at a level that you wouldn't think modern man could really think about. It's because they see religion as the key threat to their power structure in China and the key group that they confront around the world, I believe.
That's very, very interesting. Let's do look a little bit more around the world. We've already talked about China. I am thinking, I've heard this, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that apparently Christians are actually the most persecuted religion in the world. Is that right?
They are. They are. I mean, it's the breadth of the faith. It's everywhere, virtually around the world. It is also targeted particularly by tyrannical governments. And then you get in the Muslim region of the world, it gets targeted by radical Islamists. And increasingly, and we didn't see this until the last really 10 years, in India, you're seeing this radical Hindu nationalism agenda come up and has targeted a lot of Christians. It's a sad commentary.
I'm thinking of Nigeria, where thousands of Christians are being slaughtered, and I don't see any outcry in the international community to speak of, and I don't see anything being done about it. Am I wrong?
No, and what you've got is really the next caliphate is the radical Muslim jihadists have centered there in that Sahel region around Nigeria in Africa to establish the next caliphate. And they've got a big head of steam up, and there's a lot of different radical Islamic groups that are in the region. The killing is going, and they're doing everything they can to drive all the Christians out of the entire region and to establish this caliphate.
And the international community isn't reacting, it seems to me.
No, and I don't know if it's just, okay, it's Africa and bad things happen in Africa, or if it's, I got plenty of other things to worry about, or naivete, or whatever it might, or maybe it's just because it's Christians and it's Christians. Now, there's enough of them anyway, so, you know, whatever happens, happens. I don't know why there hasn't been, but this thing is really bad. It's forcing people to flee. It needs to be confronted now before it gets worse, and it will get worse if it is not confronted.
Well, I hope if you have a chance to speak with the president, you'll bring that up to him. Let's talk a bit about anti-Semitism. Now, of course, everyone's heard of anti-Semitism. This is something that's been going on for thousands of years, a deep and profound violation of religious freedom. But it seems to me, and you know, I've been around now quite a few years, that it's worse than I've ever seen it. And I was born after the Holocaust and so forth, but I have never seen anti-Semitism of the kind that seems to be unleashed. And ironically, it seems to have been unleashed by October 7th. That is, the mass killing of 1,200 Jews led to more anti-Semitism instead of less.
I know. What a sad commentary, what you just said. I looked at this, and I remember asking a rabbi friend of mine. I said, I thought we were past this level and this nature of anti-Semitism, this level of hate. I don't know if you can call it even anti-Semitism. You just need to call it just pure raw hate. And I he said something I thought was interesting. He said, you know, evil hates God. And the Jewish people in our faith, these are God's chosen people, and they're apple of his eye. And that hate's just not going to, that hate comes from evil. And it's just going to continue and does continue. Because I really thought we were past it. I thought World War II, the Holocaust, kind of said, okay, we will not do this again. We will not go and see this or allow this to happen again. And you're virtually back. I was in Israel in December of that year of the massacre of the Jewish people. And, you know, a bunch of the world was moving away from Israel at that time. And they were happy to see people come in that would be supportive of them. But they were ready to fight to the death. They said, we will not be the Jewish people that lose the state of Israel. Even if the rest of the world walks away from us, we're going to fight. You know, God bless them. But why did this thought even come up? You got one Jewish nation in the world out of the 149 countries in the world, something like that.
And it's only about 90 miles across.
Yeah. You know, come on. Can we not accommodate this?
And realize there were specific historic reasons for the formation of the nation of Israel that came out of the Holocaust. And we have other nations that are primarily made up of people of one faith, and nobody blinks an eye. And this idea,
you got 50 majority Muslim countries in the world. Okay.
Which is great, you know, except some of those countries are forcing Christians out. They're forcing Jews out. They're forcing Baha'i out.
Yeah.
And Sikhs out and so forth. Which brings me to Syria. Syria, the Assads were just finally pushed out of the country, the brutal Assad family, but it's now controlled by an Islamist government. I'm sure you're watching carefully to see whether that Islamist government keeps its promise that it said it would not engage in religious persecution. Are they keeping that promise? And what do you think is going on in Syria?
My estimation, they're not keeping that promise. And I think the only answer in this case really is that you need a federated Syria where you have different states, like what's taken place in northern Iraq with the Kurdish region, where the Kurds defend themselves. They are armed and they defend themselves. I think you're going to need to have that same thing take place in Syria. Years ago, when I was in the Senate, Joe Biden and I did this bill together where we called for a federated Iraq. Three states, one country, and that'd be a Kurdish state, a Sunni state, and a Shia state, but in one country. And we got a majority vote in the Senate for it because Iraq really is three different places. And, you know, these things were all forced together by Europeans after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and Syria is a similar situation. We lost that fight in the Senate at that time, but my hope is in Syria that we allow groups of religious minorities like the Christians to arm themselves, like the Kurds have done in northern Iraq, because we might defend them for a while. I don't think actually we would in this situation. But if we don't, and if they are not allowed to defend themselves, they will flee. And you'll see a substantial Christian population in Syria follow the same track as what happened in Iraq, where you went from 2 million Christians to 200,000. And they fled to the U.S. or Europe or other places in the region, and they'll just be run out of there just like they have almost every other Middle East country.
And I think what you were just describing, partitioning a country by religion, illustrates what you were saying earlier, how if you do not have a strong foundation of religious freedom as a fundamental right as part of your society, you end up fractured, you end up splintered, you end up segregating yourself from each other, as opposed to engaging and living with each other, working with each other, and having that kind of comity that allows for a free and a prosperous society.
Yeah. I was just in the Kurdish region of Iraq earlier this year in Erbil. It's prospering. It's growing. They've got construction going on all over the place because they protect their religious minorities, and it's a part of their culture. It's a part of their existence and belief. And the Christian community is actually growing there. It's one of the few in the Middle East that's actually growing. And you're going, okay, this is what a religious freedom foundation can and will give you. But you've got to fight for it, and you've got to protect it, and you've got to protect people's faith who you do not agree with their faith. You got to protect it. And if you won't, you're just going to see people flee, people being killed. And that's my real concern about Syria. You're really at this wet cement portion of Syria's reforming of what it's going to be like. And either you've got to ironclad protect this religious freedom, or you have to let these religious minorities arm them and defend themselves.
Let's look at Russia. Of course, Russia has invaded Ukraine, but also, I'm an Eastern Orthodox Christian in the American Orthodox Church in America, but it's all one church. It seems to me that the Russian government is, while not suppressing Orthodoxy the way it did under the Soviets, it tried to destroy Orthodox end of the Soviets and didn't succeed. Actually, I was once touring St. Petersburg, and I went to St. Isaac's Cathedral, which is now a museum, where they have the icon, really beautiful icons made of mosaic and so forth. And in the far corner, there was a little active church. And I thought, well, I'm going to go in there and light a candle. And this babushka came out yelling at me in Russian. And I couldn't understand a word she was saying, but I know what she was saying. She was saying, this is a church. This is not a tourist spot. Get out of here. And I put my arms up. I said, but I'm Orthodox, but I'm Orthodox. And within 10 seconds, I was out of that little church. And I said to my wife, I said, now we know why the Soviets couldn't destroy the Russian Orthodox Church. But we find in Russia that Christian churches that are not Orthodox are being suppressed.
Yeah, they are. And that's, again, the founder's beauty of wisdom of no established national church. You basically have in Russia right now under Putin, an established national church in the Russian Orthodox Church. And they formed a kind of symbiotic relationship with Putin's government. And so the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church has given speeches in favor of the war against another dominantly Orthodox country in Ukraine that was Russian Orthodox and split off to be Ukrainian Orthodox. And that's the problem with that. It gets co-opted. And unfortunately, this has happened in several Orthodox countries where the government closeness to the dominant church puts it in that position. But you're seeing heavy religious persecution. Russia is one of the worst countries on religious persecution around the world. But if you're Russian Orthodox, you're fine. You're in good shape.
And the irony is, he was a member of the KGB, of the government that tried to literally obliterate the Orthodox faith in Russia. And there were at least 1 million martyrs, as my understanding, between 1917 and the end of the fall of the Soviet Union. And to have, I can tell you as an Eastern Orthodox Christian, that has actually divided the Orthodox world as well. So, I mean, it affects unity coming and going when you have suppression of faith. But then in Ukraine, which is under severe stress, obviously, you've had the government pick which Orthodox church should be the one that is allowed to actually practice and have monasteries and have churches. And I don't think that a war actually excuses the suppression of a church by the government. I know they're afraid that, well, they're friendly with the Russian church. Well, if somebody is friendly with the Russians and helping Russia, you go after them. But you don't go after the entire church because there had been previous affiliations between the Russian church and the Ukrainian church.
Yeah, I've had numerous conversations with Ukrainian religious people, government officials about this. Ukraine is far better than Russia on this. Russia just really, if you're not Russian Orthodox, they're killing people and removing people and all. In Ukraine, it becomes more kind of a tactical war issue. Is this a branch of the Russian Orthodox Church that's feeding information back into Moscow, into the war machinery that's there against us? And so you've got that huge stress of war that's taking place. But I've said, you've got to allow people to practice their faith. And you don't want to be thrown into the camp of those who persecute people for their faith, because you don't do that. And so you got to walk one.
It creates a conflict when the message is we're supporting freedom, and then you suppress freedom more than I think is necessary. Of course, I'm not there. But I think it creates a conflict in terms of your war message and what you're standing up for in the world. Just a few other countries, because we're almost out of time. Is Myanmar still going after Muslims in the way it was?
Yes, and it's worse now. It's not just the Rohingya Muslims that they're just brutally kicked out. I mean, it was when I went to their refugee camp in Cox Bazar in Bangladesh, I heard some of the most horrific stories I've ever heard in this work. Bayonets stuck up women's vaginas and them killed in front of their mothers. It was a level of brutality that's horrific. But now it's also the Christians. There are Christian communities in the Chin and Karen in Burma that the military government is going after and bombing, and China and Russia is backing the military government. Again, they're going at this faith community. My point of being, you've got an operational axis of evil now, we talked about earlier in the show, that is operational in places like Burma. Before, the Chin and Karen, who are dominantly a Christian community, could pretty well stand off and stand their ground against the military government. They were armed, the Chin and Karen. They controlled certain patches of land. They'd kind of reached an accommodation for a while, or there was a bit of accommodation And now they're getting, their churches are getting bombed. They're being attacked, particularly by Russian and Chinese equipment given to the military government. And we're going to have to go in and again stand for religious freedom as part of our national and global strategic interest here in a place like Burma.
Once again, you know that. I didn't know that, because I don't see it reported in the media, and I'm not as focused on religious freedom as you are. As you said, you're a specialist, now you can really focus. Is it because the Western media doesn't understand what you're saying in terms of the overall importance of religious freedom to general liberty altogether?
I think we've never looked at it as a strategic issue. And that's the thing that, as I've been studying more and more, working to get this book out on China's war on faith, this is a grand strategy of China. And they're a long ways down the road. And they're very effective at going at religion and religious people, and they see them as their enemy. And that's why I said earlier in the show that the Chinese Communist Party is the greatest single threat to religion and religious people around the world today. I don't say that lightly. Because there's plenty of threats to people of faith, whether it's radical Islam or it's Hindu nationalism or it's, you name 20 of them. But this is the most organized, this is the most strategic, this is the most powerful, and they've got a real head of steam going. And we aren't even thinking in these terms yet.
No, we're not.
Think about this. Who you focus in these areas. Where do you think our national strategy is?
We don't seem to have a national strategy, and we haven't had for a long time.
Right, and that's why I think in our national security strategy, we should identify religious freedom as a key topic in our national security strategy that's annually put out or regularly put out in front of the Congress.
I think that's, in this interview, that's the most profound thing you said, among many things, because it had never occurred to me how important those two issues are, not just in terms of rights, but in terms of our own freedom and our own national security. Well, we're just about out of time, and I don't want everything to be down in a downer. We've been talking a lot of bad news. What are the bright spots that you see with where religious freedom might be improving?
Well, I think it's improving in the United States. As I said at the outset, as so goes the U.S., the rest of the world will follow us. If it's improving here, that's going to help around the rest of the world. I think it's going to start improving in Western Europe. There's been a lot of commercial interest going against Christianity, and that seems to be softening. There was a 30% increase in baptisms in France this Easter, which is incredibly heartening that maybe there's a kind of a bottoming out and starting. Maybe we'll have a new Prague spring of faith this time around in Europe. I'm encouraged to see that taking place. I'm encouraged that there's more interest in religious freedom. For a long time, it was a really kind of a boutique issue that only committed Christians in the Congress were interested in pushing for us as a U.S. government. Well, now it's a much broader reach of government that's interested and sees this as important. They don't see it as strategic yet, but they see it as important. I think those are all bright spots.
That's terrific. And I know you're going to continue to try to educate and fight for this very important issue. And when your book comes out, I hope you'll come on the podcast.
You in particular would appreciate this, because I think you would look at it and go, yeah. I had an interesting talk with a former executive at National Public Radio. This is a year ago or so. And I was talking to him about how China attacks all the faiths. And this is part of their strategy. And he had never seen it that way. Here's a guy that was in the news every day. He had seen, oh, yeah, they got it, took on the Buddhists. Oh, yeah, they go after the Falun Gong. He'd never seen it as part of a much bigger strategy to control the country. But of course it is. Of course it is. And I think that's really the step, the corner we've got to turn.
Well, Sam, thank you for engaging this issue so energetically. And thanks for being on the podcast. We'll talk to you again.
My pleasure. God bless you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.